The opinions expressed by guests of this show are their own and do not necessarily align with those of us here at the Animal Soulmates podcast.
I remember, oh man, it's such a brutal place to live. Like I say Bali is hell on earth for dog lovers. Like it is. This is hell. If you love dogs, this is not the place you want to be living because you're surrounded. You see it. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you see it, you see more of it.
Welcome to the Animal Soulmates podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Abby Viscardi. I'm an animal welfare scientist and, more importantly, an obsessed dog mom. I believe that the unconditional love and connection that we share with our animals is more powerful than we realize. This podcast will honor the stories of these amazing creatures that have walked with us and changed our lives forever. So join me, and together we will explore the true power of the human-animal bond. Welcome back to another episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. This week as co-host is the final dog in my pack, Merida, who was a former street dog in Puerto Rico. And I felt like she could relate to my next guest more than any of my other dogs, because this week we're chatting with Prue Barber, an absolutely amazing woman who has dedicated her life to rescuing animals in Bali. I had been following Mission Possible on Instagram for years, and the stories of dogs being rescued from the brink of death and transforming into these incredibly beautiful animals, seemingly healed both physically and emotionally, were just incredible. I feel like we as Instagram followers rarely get to see behind the curtain at all of the people who make those transformations happen behind the scenes. And so I was so thrilled when I reached out to Prue and she agreed to chat with me. And let me tell you, chat we did. This recording lasted almost 2.5 hours. So we're going to split it into two separate episodes. This week's episode is mainly focused on Prue's journey as a graphic designer in Melbourne, Australia, to an animal rescuer in Bali, Indonesia, and many of the challenges that she encountered along the way. Prue is such a fighter for the mistreated and neglected animals in Bali and is truly an inspiration to me. So please enjoy episode 4, part 1 with Prue Barber, an animal rescuer in Bali.
My name is Prue Barber. I am from Melbourne, Australia. I'm now 44 years old and I'm presently based in Bali, Indonesia.
And what was life like growing up in Australia?
Yeah, life was great. I had a really beautiful childhood, very much a family involved in animals, but we lived in suburbia, so we lived in the city, but we did have a few years in the countryside. When my dad turned about 40, they say you change your wife or change your life, so thankfully, he changed his life. And we moved up to the country to a little place called Barham on the Murray River, where my parents ran a motel. They bought the motel and then ran it. And us kids went to school in the country town and made friends with the kids, obviously. But a lot of them lived on farms. So we were very much then, you know, introduced to that kind of lifestyle of animals and freedom and barefoot and just, yeah, no, not really any restrictions. I was of a good age. I was about 5 when we moved up there. So I had that really important, impressionable kind of period where for me, I loved it. My brother absolutely loved it. My older brother, he's very big into reptiles and that's very much where it seeded from. But my older sister, she was in that transitional period where she was going through puberty. So it was like she was the city kid in the country. So that wasn't cool. So that was very hard. So we've all got very different interpretations of that part of our life. But yeah, we're growing up. We had, we always had dogs. My parents had a dog. My dad gifted my mother a dog, Jody, when they first started dating, I think. It wasn't engagement, but I know he gifted her Jody. And he was a little poodle, and he was their first love, their first child together. And yeah, just went from there with us as the kids came into the picture.
Did you know when you were growing up that you had this connection with animals, or that you would do something in your career that involved animals?
Oh, gosh, no. I think when I was growing up, very much I was connected to my animals. We had the family dogs, which were very much part of our family, to the point that my father wouldn't visit me in London when I lived there because of the dogs. Like, he wouldn't go away because of the dogs, which I think to this day he regrets, because he's realized he's missed out on a lot because of the dogs, because they could have been put into care and taken care of for a few weeks. But he was very much committed to the animals. And then I see that very much as paid forward for all of us children who've got kids. My siblings have kids. I don't have kids. But all of us who have dogs, it's always about the dog. It's not about the kids and what they're going to do. It's about what do we do with the dogs when we go away. So, yeah, and I had my own pet rabbit when I was younger too, and he was Ralph. I was very fond of him, and we had a really interesting bond. And, yeah, I guess also my cousins who we were very close to, they lived on a farm. So we obviously were, you know, encountered animals there as well, the sheep and the pigs and the horses and things like that. So, yeah, I kind of was around animals. For a city kid, it's pretty impressive. I was around animals quite a bit.
And so your career trajectory, you didn't imagine it with animals?
Oh, gosh, no. I was very creative at school. I was in the art room most of the time when it was, you know, lunchtime or recess. I'd be down in the art room creating stuff, which then took me on to doing graphic design. And so I studied graphic design in Melbourne. I then went into advertising for a hot minute, which was interesting, but it wasn't really my vibe. And then I ended up moving to London for 4 years and continued working in graphics. And then I've freelanced probably pretty much since then. Once I returned to Melbourne, I continued on by freelancing and have done since then. It's now called being a digital nomad, but yeah. I did it when the internet was basically invented.
Wow.
I started doing it that. Yeah. So that's how, yeah, I ended up in Bali. I had that flexibility.
And so Bali was not a work related?
No. So my partner and I lived in Sydney. I didn't enjoy Sydney at all. I was mid-30s and I couldn't really see where we were going, I guess. And I knew that he'd never done the world trip, the backpack on the no agenda, quit your job, get rid of your lease kind of stuff. Whereas I'd done that as a 20-year-old. So I suggested to him that he needed to do it because I could see that we were just getting into just bad lifestyle patterns that you do in Sydney in your 30s. And he was a designer as well, and he wanted to create designer rugs. So he had a supplier and a developer, a manufacturer in Nepal. And he decided that, okay, yeah, I'll pack up and I'll head there first. And I said, yeah, you need to do it on your own. You need to have this time. Everyone needs to do this. Like, it's really important in anyone's life to have that freedom, even for 4 weeks, I prefer to have it that you don't have a set time, especially if you can work whilst you're traveling, because then you can really just decide when to pack up and leave to the next town and to the next experience, you know. Anyway, so he left and then I packed up my life and I followed about 4 weeks later, and we ended up traveling, I think, for 12 months total.
Wow.
Yeah, well, we were able to work online whilst we were traveling. So we did Nepal. We did a really random route because we didn't really manage the wet season and monsoons. And anyway, we did Nepal and we ended up doing Malaysia and Thailand. I went to China for a hot minute, but that was a resourcing trip for pet accessories. And we came back through India. But what's the interest? This is the real crossroads where when I was in Nepal in this random little guest house, I met this lady was sitting there with her computer and she's full hippie, like jingly jangly and long hair, but you're old school hippie, not your try hard hippie. Her name was Rani and she had computer problems. And to this day, she still has computer problems and will ask us questions. Anyway, this is 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And she asked a question about the computer and then we got chatting and she said that she lived in Goa. She was English. She lived in Goa and worked with stray dogs. I was like, wow, God, like, what's the deal with that? Because I'd not noticed stray dogs. Like, we don't have them where I live in Australia. We do up north, but which I now know. But in Melbourne, of course not. You don't have dogs on the street. But I had noticed quite a bit of it in Nepal. But when you're in a different culture, you just go, oh, it's just part of the culture. It is what it is when you're traveling. You know, you don't really get connected. It's an odd thing. Anyway, Rani was just telling me about what she did. And she said, look, the kindest thing you can do is give them a full belly. Like if you are traveling and you see a dog in need, like just give it a full belly. Give it some rice and some milk or whatever you eggs, whatever you can get your hands on. I was like, okay, that's cool. So we ended up parting out ways, but she did say, when you come to Goa, if you pass through Goa, come and stay with me. I've got teepees. And I was like, what? I've always wanted to live in a teepee. So I've had like two things. I've always wanted to live in a teepee or and a treehouse. Oh, not the same time, but and so I was like, wow, this is wild. Like, yeah, cool. Let's go do that. Anyway, we continued on with our travels and I started to really notice the stray dogs. Like then when someone says it, you start to notice it. And I was like, holy heck, like there's a lot here. But in what's really interesting too, having done our traveling without knowing my future, you see how different cultures treat the dogs. And India, they were always very well looked after. They weren't mistreated. They weren't, from what I saw, I wasn't on the internet. I mean, I don't think Instagram was a thing at the time of me traveling. I know we didn't have video on our cameras, I'm pretty sure, or it chewed up too much of our memory. So I didn't capture a lot of it. But India, yeah, you know, they've got the cows in the street and that's just part of like the freeway is a cow could be in the middle of it. And the dogs are no different from what I saw. But of course, they don't have access to medical and when there is a maimed dog and you've got that. And then I saw that with Rani once we ended up visiting her, that access to resources, access to cars, medical, all of it's really, really hard. And if you're a dog lover, that's extra hard. But the one time I was in India and this is quite a funny story. I can't remember where we were. We're in some tourist town. Anyway, I got up in the morning because I wanted to go and feed this mama and her puppies. And I think it was like 7 a.m. and I went down and I got different things and found the dogs and I started to feed them. And there was this young Indian guy, very well dressed. He was leaning on a Vespa, like act cool dude, like, yeah, you know, he's the cool kid. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm feeding the stray dogs. He's like, why are you giving the food to them? He said, there's people down there that need the food more than the dogs do. And I was really taken aback. It was the first time I'd been confronted with that kind of rationale. And I looked at him, I said, do you feed the people? And he's like, what? I was like, well, are you feeding the people? And he's like, well, and his friend was there. And his friend was like, uh-oh. And he's like, well, yeah. I said, well, great. You feed the people, I'll feed the dogs, and everyone's happy, right? And he was like, wasn't expecting that response. I wasn't expecting to say that response. I really didn't. But I remember going back to where we were staying and I just burst into tears. I said to my partner, I just did something, an act of kindness, and I just got trolled for it.
Like, yeah.
I just got judged on a negative for doing a positive. And I still can't figure out this rationale, especially in animal welfare, which we'll get to later. Yeah. This disrespect and this negativity attached to something incredibly selfless.
Mm-hmm.
It's never left my mind. And I kind of come to that now that I'm in rescue, that when people start to say, why do you help the dogs, not the people? We are helping the people when we help the dogs. So let's get that straight. Mm-hmm. When we're helping dogs, especially where I'm jumping, but whilst I'm in Bali, we've got rabies, we've got poverty, we've got no education. And it doesn't mean a family doesn't love their pet when it's got mange or scabies. Just means they need help. So in us helping their animal helps them. When we vaccinate their dog for rabies, we're helping the community. When we sterilize those dogs, we're helping the island as a whole. We're helping the tourism industry. We're helping the community as a whole. So when people now start to like, because now I've got educated and I'm obviously fiercely involved in it, don't say we're not helping people when we help dogs. We're helping the people more than you're helping people by giving $5 for, you know, a bag of rice, because we're helping a collective. We're helping. When we vaccinate a dog for rabies, we're protecting the whole community from a lethal virus that's basically at extreme levels at the moment here in Bali. So yeah, anyway, that was the Indian story. And yeah, it's never left me.
No, it's interesting that you say that, because in the animal welfare space, we talk a lot about One Health right now. So it's the health of people, animals, and the environment, and how interconnected all of that is. And this is such a perfect example of that, that yeah, in treating the health of these animals, we're improving public safety and public health. And yeah, it's these things are all not mutually exclusive. It's all so interconnected.
Absolutely.
It's interesting that this was like 10 years ago, you were kind of confronted with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the ignorance of people as well. And that's just people wanting to have their say and before keyboard warriors, you know, they actually said it to your face and you could actually respond and see the reactions. And it's interesting when you say the environment as well, because I've been wanting to implement a project here, which just I've been pretty busy, but, you know, I haven't been able to pull it together and get the right team. It takes a lot of work and we're very small. But that whole One Health idea that the environment is connected to the animals, connected to the people, like we're all connected. When you have rubbish that is laying around and you're allowing dogs to rip that apart, and well, that's going to upset the community, but you're also obviously making a mess. But not saying you don't want to feed the dogs, but when the dogs have access to a lot of food, that means they can reproduce more easily, right? So you need to be able to sterilize the animals, make sure the dogs are fed properly so they're not ripping around the bins, but have your rubbish section, like, you know, in bins. But here it's very difficult.
Oh, I can imagine. It's a different world out there, I imagine.
It really is, yeah.
How long were you in India for then?
I think we were there for 6 months, I want to say, because we traveled around for a fair bit. Yeah. And I still remember one dog that I saw that was just, well, I won't explain it, but it never left my mind. But I didn't know what to do. We're on transit, which then in coming to Bali and seeing tourists in that situation, like they're in transit and they find something that needs help. I get that. We need to have resources available to make it easier for people everywhere to help animals in need, not just in Bali, but globally. So yeah, about 6 months we're in India.
And then you made your way from India over to Bali?
Yeah. So then we were in Goa and I think we had another 4 weeks or something in India and we were supposed to head back to Australia. And I said to my partner at the time, not sure I can go back to the 9 to 5 or the 8 to 8, you know, working in a design agency, working for the guys to make more money for themselves. Like it's just, I didn't really know where we sat in the scheme of things. And I said to him, oh, I've researched Bali, Indonesia. I've never been there. You've never been there. It's cultural, you know, it's affordable. It's beautiful. It's only 6 hours from home for me, 4 hours for him or something. How about we try Bali? And I said, I found a tree house we could live in. So I wanted, that's the tree house teepee thing. Yeah. So I remember in the teepee and I had this conversation with him and we booked it. And I said to my family, yeah, we're not coming home yet. Like we're going to try Indonesia, see what that's like. So long story short, we flew in, we stayed down in Seminyak and then that's quite a touristy hub area. And my girlfriends had all said, oh, Bali's amazing. The food's incredible. The beaches are great. The fashion's amazing. So in my mind, I thought it was going to be like Noosa in Australia, which is this really beautiful beach town in Australia, white beaches, incredible restaurants, like very shishi. Oh my Lord, we arrived. We were shell-shocked. The infrastructure in Seminyak is worse than central Nepal.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. The footpaths are all falling apart. Well, for the amount of tourism and the amount of buzz this place gets. And then you think about the money that comes in, the maintenance just isn't there. And look, I'm still battling with that 12 years later. Like I'm still, why can you guys not fix this place? If you're really aiming at tourists, you got to make this place nicer. Anyway, you know, footpaths falling apart, you fall into the sewer, people riding their scooters on the street, on the footpaths, just chaos. The beaches were revolting because we'd come just after wet season. So all the now learning the pollution comes from up in the villages, down the river system into the ocean, right? So we got to the beach and it was covered in litter, like just, and we're like, what have we just done? So that's when I said, let's go up to this place called the tea houses where there are tree houses. And so we finally did some nice accommodation. We really lashed out that month because we'd been on a $20 a day budget. This was a lot more. And we ended up moving to Ubud, which was more central in Bali, not near the beaches. It's a rice field area. It's a lot cooler. It was already getting its buzz around since Eat, Pray, Love, you know.
Oh, yes.
It's the spiritual center. That's questionable whether it's a spiritual center. Well, it depends what spirituality you're into, narcissism or spiritual, finding yourself or finding the rest of the world. Anyway, enough on that. So we ended up moving up there. We got into the tree houses and it was absolutely gorgeous. I loved it. I felt really happy. And it was remote, you know, it was further out. And that's where I think my country girl comes back in, right? I'm really not a city girl, even though most of my childhood was in the city. That 3 years in the country, 4 years in the country has always stayed with me. And even to this moment, like I want to go further and further and further out away from the chaos of city life. Yeah. So we were in Ubud and my partner said to me, oh, there's a dog shelter down the road. You know, you've always wanted to get into yoga and you've always wanted to meet, you know, help dogs. And it was almost like a challenge. was kind of a bit pissed at it. Anyway, I was like, oh, okay, whatever. So I did. It's probably the biggest regret he's ever had is putting me to that challenge, because I ended up going into the rescue. I tried to contact them. The contacting anyone here at that time was just, you couldn't really get hold of anyone. So I ended up going into their clinic. I remember sitting down with the girl, sitting on some dog food, because I have dog food piled up in bags. And we sat down. She's like, yeah, what do you want? And I was like, oh, I want to volunteer. Like, can I help? Yeah, you can. What do you do? And I said, oh, I'm actually a graphic designer, but that's irrelevant. Like, I want to walk dogs, pick up poo, like whatever. But I did say, and she said, oh, okay, yeah, we're going to be on the project in 6 months' time. And the project's TV show in Australia at peak time, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, whatever. And it gets a lot of eyeballs on the screen. And being from marketing, advertising, design, marketing, you know, all of that, I was like, whoa, that's really huge. I said, okay, can we discuss your website? Yeah, what's wrong with that? She was really defensive. And I said, yeah, well, the dog, the logo looks like it's rabid. So that's really not a great start, because it had teeth. And she's like, oh, that's the founder's artwork. And I said, that's really nice, like, but it's not ideal for, especially Bali, right? Anyway, I was more gentle. I'm just being quite straight now. But anyway, it took a while for them to budge on it. Anyway, I said to them, look, I don't really give a shit about it. Like, I'm here to help the animals, but you know, if you want professional opinion that would, you know, I can give it to you. So I sat down with them and I said, okay, you're going to be on the project, right? And they're like, yeah. And I said, I watch the story and I get really emotional. Yeah. I want to donate. How do I do it? And Ebony, the girl, she's like, oh, you click here and then you click here and then you click here. And then I said, I'm gone. I'm done. You just missed my $50. She's like, well, you know, people should be have more patience or something. I was like, no, it's, that's not how it works. You need to make it really bloody easy. If I want to give $50, let me just give it to you. Don't make it difficult. And let's not have, and I said again, I don't, do you want to make more donations or do you not? Yeah, we do. Okay. So either listen to me and we change it, or we don't and I walk dogs. I'm really not bothered. Like, it's really no skin off my nose, because this isn't my gig. This is your gig. So anyway, off that, we rebranded, we redid the website. They went on the project. Unfortunately, they didn't pay for their website server. They're on a free server at the time, so the site crashed. But they made a lot of money, and that was the real eye-opener of how marketing, design, and everything is so important in, well, any business, but in the not-for-profit space. Sorry, I'm going a bit on a tangent, but as a creative, I realized, why do charities have to look so daggy? Like, why do they have to be so uncool? Why aren't we making them cool? Like, I was in my 30s. It's like, no 25-year-old's going to be interested in this. When why can't you be cool and sexy like a fashion brand or a street brand, or, you know, relevant to the animals, but make it cool to adopt, make it fun to adopt, make it, you know, inspiring to want to be part of that movement, rather than it being, oh, we're an old charity and we always have to scrape for money and, oh, poor us, woe is me. No. So that was my, yeah, that was my introduction to rescue. And I remember going into the clinic and there was this little dog, I might get teary now. He was sitting in a cage and he had a little jumper on and he was like all hunched over and he just looked up at me. And I said to Ebony, I was like, what is that? She's like, what? I was like, what is that? She's like, it's a dog. I was like, I know, but it's got no hair. I had never seen anything like it. And she's just really nonchalant. She's like, oh, it's scabies and mange and he's got that, this and the other thing. I was like, well, I'm not from this. Like, this is really unusual to me. Like, I don't see this. And most people in the world don't see this. And this is real is social media. Social media existed, but it wasn't as prevalent as engaging. And that was my Winston. That was my first little dog that I met. And I remember just watching Winnie and he was so bloody sad and so broken. He was only 3 months old. He had a stomach this big from worms and he'd been found on the side of the road somewhere. And yeah, and that was my first love. That was my first boy. I ended up bringing him home. We were still living at this treehouse place. And I remember, oh man, it's such a brutal place to live. Like, I say Bali is hell on earth for dog lovers. Like, it is. This is hell. If you love dogs, this is not the place you want to be living, because you're surrounded. You see it. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you see it, you see more of it, right? So when we were staying at the tree houses, we had a rice field view, and I didn't know the culture. I didn't know the way of life. Like, I was very new. I was 4 weeks in, there was this big, beautiful dog that used to come to our villa. Well, not villa. I hate that word. Whatever, our little place. And I'd let him in. I can't remember what I called him, but he was huge. It was like he was a Great Dane mixed with a Barley dog. And then one day he didn't turn up. And I was like, where's so-and-so? Oh, he died. I was like, what? And they said, yeah, he got poisoned. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And they said, oh, he died 2 days ago on the thing. I was like, and so then I was furious. I was like, on a mission. I was like, who would do that? Why would you do that? And then there were several stories. One person said, oh, they were playing in the rice fields and the rice farmer got upset. So they poisoned them, which now in retrospect, I don't agree with poisoning 100%. Poisoning in the rice field can be from rat bait. It doesn't mean it's intentional, but then there is intentional poisoning. And two, your dog shouldn't be playing in someone's work area. Like, these guys bust their ass like every day in that heat, broken backs, like planting rice for us to eat. You don't let dogs wallop in it and think that's okay. So now in hindsight, now with 12 years, and I hear bullies are foreigners say, oh, my dog was poisoned for playing in the rice field. It's like, well, why did you let your dog play in someone's workplace? You know, like, come on, you're responsible for that. I'm not condoning the poison. Take some responsibility. And something happens here in Bali. People lose all responsibility. Maybe it's global now. I don't know. But everyone wants to blame someone else. It's like, no, you need to take, that's your fault. Like, anyway, so that's what happened. Tiger, that's his name. That's what happened to Tiger. And so I was so upset. They said it was either that or it's the lady complained to the management. There was a lady that had kids staying there and she'd let Tiger and the other dog into her villa, but then she decided she didn't want them anymore. She had the kids and then she complained about it. And I gave it to her. I said, so first of all, you allowed them in. They never needed to come in to play with your kids. And now you've decided you don't want them to play with your kids. You've complained to management and now they're dead. That's on you. Again, like, that's on you. If you complain to management in a developing country where poisoning is a very common thing, that's on you. You know, I'm very much about calling people out on their shit.
Yeah. So we might be jumping ahead a bit, but that was something I was really interested to talk to you about, is the cultural differences of how animals are viewed in Bali versus the way they might be viewed in North America or Australia. It does seem very different.
Yeah. So if you look back at the heritage of the Bali dog, so the Bali dog is an actual breed from Bali, the island. It's not just a dog in Bali, which again, I learned over time. They're actually the local breed and they're actually the purest breed in the world. They've dated back 12,000 years. They're dated back, their DNA. They precede the Australian dingo, which I thought it was the other way around. I thought the dingo came first, but actually they've, from my research, I might be wrong, but the Bali dog came first and then when the countries separated, or the land separated, right, and then the islands were developed and then Australia floated off, then the dingoes were on that piece of land and that's how the dingoes developed. So the Bali dog actually had a role in the community. So they're community dogs. So they weren't actually owned. They were the dogs of the village. They were the village dogs and they had a job to do in the village. It was to keep vermin away. Because they didn't have plastics and things like that. They would eat the leftovers. They would, and that's how they survived. They ate leftovers. They ate whatever was on the locals' plate or in the rubbish bin. They also, so they got rid of rats and snakes. They also protected the village from other stray dogs. And another interesting one that I read somewhere is that they actually had a job role in the rice field to run through the rice fields to get the birds to get off the rice so they wouldn't peck the rice. So the dogs would run through and do that. Now they've just got things on, they've got other contraptions that they use. They don't use dogs. But yeah, they had a role before other inventions came into place, like poisoning for rats and for security. Security was a huge thing. So often, even now, when you come to Bali, there'll be a Bali dog with its pose, like it has the hands like this, sitting out the front of the compound, just on the steps, watching the world go by. But they're basically the doorbell. They'll tell anyone that someone's entering. So if you watch an Indonesian or a Balinese walk into a compound, they're not fazed by dogs at all because they know it's part of the, whereas if you get a foreigner walk through my gate, they're beside themselves. But if you get a Balinese to walk through my gate, they're just like, yeah. They just ignore them. I personally would shit myself if I went into a house with 10 dogs barking at me. And even if the owner was like, don't worry, they're not aggressive. I'd be like, whatever. Like, I kind of don't want to die today. So that was very much their role, is security. And that's still today what they use the Bali dogs for, is security. And then you've got also the spiritual part of it where, look, this story changes, so I'm not sure where it's at anymore. But a black dog would ward off the black spirit. So if you had a dog that was black, has to be fully black. There can be no white, no other color. That's a very good dog because that's going to protect the house against spirits. Another one is if the dog has dark markings on its tongue, that's a great sign. Again, it's going to ward off evil spirits. So then you've got that overlap within Balinese or Hinduism. But then as you've progressed, obviously, the influence of the Western world, social media, pedigrees, status, you know, all of that, it's totally changed.
So that you're seeing the effect of that over in Bali?
Oh, huge. Yeah. God, yeah. Consumerism of dogs is revolting. Yeah. As in buying them. So, well, when they had the first rabies outbreak, the really big one, I want to say it was 2014 or 2017, they banned the import and export of dogs into Bali. But it was already too late because a lot of Western breeds had already come out. And what commonly happens here, because that's why us rescues exist, is that that some owners won't get medical care for their animal. Either they don't know or they don't want to or they can't afford it. I don't know their reasons. I've never met someone and got a straight answer. They throw them on the street. So then when you've thrown them on the street, then they're going to interbreed with the local dog. So the Bali dog DNA has been really diluted. Now we've just got a mixture of mutts, I guess you'd say. So you've got your pit bulls and Bali dogs, you've got husky Bali dogs, you've got dashhound Bali dogs. So you've got the lot. But sadly, with the whole pedigree uptick, you know, the French bulldogs being the buzz dog for the moment. I mean, come on. Anywhere in the world, they're not great. But in a humid country, hot country, and they can hardly breathe and people think it's cute.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
It kills me. And then I've got people coming to events. I had a girl come to an event, an adoption event, and it was at a dog grooming place. And it was a hoity-toity dog groomer. And she had a dog in a t-shirt. I was like, what are you doing? Like, I said to her, why has your dog got a t-shirt on? She just looked at me and I said, that's actually animal cruelty, what you're doing on a scooter. Like, it wasn't in an aircon car. It was 30 degrees, direct sun. These dogs like this. And she just kind of looked down at me because I was working with rescue dogs. And I just thought, nah, that's animal cruelty. That's, again, you are complicit to animal cruelty. Get educated. Stop it. But people just want to believe their own things and do their own things and do what looks cool. So then we've got lots of pedigrees in cages. So I hate going into compounds. I hate driving down small streets here. I just never know what I'm going to see in a cage. It has got better. I have to admit it's gotten better, but it's not uncommon to have, again, okay, so this is another crazy thing over here is that people might buy a dog, a breed dog, a Pomeranian. Pomeranians are a thing. Shih Tzus? No, Pomeranians are the thing. And put them in a cage. Okay, why? So that they're safe or for security. Okay, wait, hang on. How is a dog trapped in a cage for security? Like that, okay, that's never made sense to me anywhere in the world. I've seen it in China. I've seen it everywhere. But then what they'll do is they leave it in the cage. It goes crazy. It's unsocialized. It comes out. It bites the kid. They want to throw it away. It gets sick. They don't want to pay for it. They throw it away. Like it's just, and then they'll just buy another one. So I've had a girl recently reporting like this family had a dog and now it's gone. Now they've got another one. Please come and take the dog. And I said, but I can't, like, there's no point. They're just going to keep replacing the dog. It's very sad for the dogs that are getting in their care, but that's something that I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't know how to fix that. That's not my thing to fix. So I gave her advice. I gave her an animal welfare lawyer to contact.
I just find, I mean, the issue that I have in North America with doing those sorts of things, and I'm sure it's the same in Bali, is that animals are property. So you don't have the right to just, unless there is an egregious, abusive situation happening, you just don't have the right to walk up on someone's property and knock on their door and say, I'm not okay with how this dog is being treated. I need to take it away. And it's crazy that a living, breathing, feeling, emotive creature is viewed as like a couch or a car. It's a piece of property.
Yes. Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. And then that takes me back and makes me sad about humans in general. Like, what's happened to empathy? Where is that gone? Sympathy, apathy, empathy. Like, there's none of that. And this is something we struggle with all the time. But this is global too. Like, obviously I'm in Indonesia, but I'm a white girl in Indonesia. Let's be real. And of course there's the race card that comes in and, oh, white, what's it called?
White privilege?
Yeah, no, they call it a white savior.
Oh.
Well, is it, or is it just someone that gives a shit? And, or is it just someone who's actually given up their life in corporate to save the dogs of your island? I know you didn't ask me to, and I'm not asking you to say thank you, But I am asking you to respect that. I get this is where I was going to, like, with you about why do people want to attack the people doing good? So when I get up hit with that, it makes me really sad and really angry that what's happened to the human race, that we are becoming like this. One, that people are allowing this behavior towards animals, ignoring it. Not to, and there's always other factors involved. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, if a man's abusing a dog, he's probably abusing his wife. And that's actually something I want to put into education with the local community, with the head of the village. If this man is able to do this to his animal, what is he doing to his wife and children? Because I can pretty much promise you it's not just stopping there.
Oh, I would love to help you in any way I can. This is something we teach at the vet college, that there is a link between animal abuse and domestic violence. It's an identified link. And 100% you're correct that if there is evidence of abuse of an animal, you need to increase your index of suspicion that there are other people in that home that are being subjected to violence. And so this goes back to the one health thing that we were talking about, that it's an animal welfare problem, right? But it is a human welfare problem as well. So in protecting our animals, we're protecting the community.
Yep. There was a case here where a guy had done something pretty brutal. And my first reaction was like, what is he doing to his wife? If the clan is the head of the village, the village chief, if you're going to turn up, like, what's that guy capable of doing in your community? Mm-hmm. Like, but then what you've got here is an overlay of culture of face. So you don't confrontation is not a thing you do here, which I've had to learn the hard way because I'm quite confrontational. When it comes to animals, like, oh, it goes to another level. So you have to walk in and smile and be nice and be like, I want to be your friend. I want to help your doggy. Like, I have to put it on. I want to vomit afterwards. But I'm only about the animal, right? I just want to get in and help the animal. I'm not here to make friends with you. I don't care about that. But as long as you let me help the animal, that's all I need. But, so what I was going to say is, like, for example, this man who did whatever to an animal and was witnessed, and a family next door filmed it. And it became a viral thing. The family then would not, he was taken to court, like the animal welfare groups got involved, took him to court, but the family didn't want to prosecute, is that the word?
Like press charges?
Well, they didn't want to be a witness, which they needed to prosecute him, because they're like, he's in our village. Like, we go to ceremony with him. Like, we don't know what he's going to do to us. Like, he's not right. So it goes all the way down, and you don't know who he's related to within their family network and what rifts that's going to have within the family. So then you've got that whole cultural overlay, the religious overlay of you don't confront each other. And that's why things get swept under the carpet here so often. Everything's a smile. The Balinese are known for their smiles. But this is a mask. This is not real life, because we know that. Like, I haven't been raised that way, to just smile at everything. Inside, there would be a lot of anger, suppressed anger and suppressed feelings and wanting to speak up, and they can't. It's just not culturally acceptable. So when it comes again to say, there's quite a lot of layers to it, but in Balinese culture, and I'm not an expert in this area, so anyone listening, and please, I'm happy to be taught, like, educated. Anyway, they marry. So we'll say you're a young couple, you meet, then you marry, the girl will move into the husband's compound, right? So then you've got, you might have a mother-in-law who's obsessed with her son or his sons, because sons are the golden child, right? Because they're going to reproduce and keep looking after the family. So the mother-in-law might be very close to the son, and the son's fallen in love and married this girl, but the mother doesn't like the daughter-in-law. So then there's friction. Oh, or the other sister-in-law, or the sister doesn't like the sister-in-law. And then there's all this friction within a compound. Because come on, how do you mix, like, 10 adults who don't really know each other or have a connection, all then have to live under the same roof, go to ceremonies day in, day out. And then you've got one of them who doesn't treat dogs very well, or animals well, or chickens in a coop, or pigs, whatever, could be anything. The girl that's married into it could be a huge dog lover. She might have 5 dogs at her parents' house that she adores. She can't bring those dogs with her. Then she's seeing this in her husband's family, but she can't say anything. She really can't. Because that's her life. Like, that's her life. That's her day in, day out. She's not going to cause trouble there. So I think that's why when we walk in, like, I'll just follow dogs into compounds and make myself at home. I mean, they're very, very kind and nice and accepting. And again, I'm always like, I'm just here to help the dog. I'm sorry to interrupt. Da-da-da. Can I help? And sometimes someone will pull me aside and go, yeah, that family's not very good with dogs. Thank you for helping. We can't do anything. Like, we're really grateful that you've come along. I had one case. Oh, my God. I wanted to punch this guy in the face. He was this big dude. I saw this dog. It got on my scooter. I followed a dog somewhere. And I followed it in to a family compound, and I spoke to the lady and she was really lovely, and that's fine. I think I gave some medicine for its skin and she was really sweet. And then I came out and got back on my scooter and I looked over the wall and there was this dog on a chain with no hair, absolutely emaciated, chained on a chain in the direct sun. Oh, the fury. Just this is in Ubud, like this is in a tourist area. I stormed in there and I saw another guy and I said, what is going on? There's a dog. No, I didn't actually, it wasn't like that. I walked in, I was like, hi, I just saw this dog. Can I, like, what's going on? What's the story? And they just had a big ceremony. So again, lots of eyes have been on this dog. No one did anything. That's normal because you can't. And I said, what's going on with this dog? Da, 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 da. And I said, can I please help it? And this is when we didn't have many vets up in Ubud. We didn't have people that could easily come out. Like, it just wasn't even a thing. It was really hard. And I had my friend at the shelter who I'd left the shelter by this time, the place I worked at for that rebranding. I've obviously moved on from that story, but I was very much on my own, so I didn't even know where to start. And this was really the starting of Mission Plausible. Anyway, I had my vet friend come out and she started the treatment, and that's before you could just give a tablet and help the dog. But this story turned out really beautifully because the family who I kind of ram-raid, like got really pissed at, Wayan, the boy, said, it's not our dog, my brother-in-law's dog, and he's really bad with animals. He's like, look at the roosters, look at the other dogs on chains. And I went around, I was like, oh my Lord. And I said, but they live next door to each other. Anyway, I found out the guy who's a big cockfighter, like he was a big rooster fighter. And they're people you don't want to mess with. Like this dude, you know, connected and, you know, it's just an industry. So I was like a world that I don't want to know about it. I don't want to be involved in that. Whatever, you do you. But I do want to help this dog. So I ended up going back and I had to speak to the owner and said, oh, you know, I saw your dog. Is it okay if I help her? Is that okay? He's like, oh, I'm so glad you came. And I said, oh, that's interesting. He said, I actually went to the temple and I prayed someone would come and save my dog. And I was like, you piece of shit. Do not bring your religion into this, mate. Look at what you own. Look at how much money you have. You don't need to pray to God. You just need a bloody vet. Like, get real. I was so angry. And I just looked at him and smiled and just thought, you are just the scum of the earth. You brought your religion into this. Like, you are just low. You are low. So anyway, that was a dog called Pooty. And we eventually got him off the chain. And the lovely family that I'd met that live in the compound, I said to them, if I pay you money, can you medicate him and feed him each day? I'll bring you money for food and you da, 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 da. They ended up adopting him. He looks amazing. They absolutely adore him. He's no longer on the chain. He's no longer anything to do with the original guy. We helped the other guys, other dogs as well. And they all came off chain too. And so the interesting thing too there is that when you, it's so confusing, especially for me, but because I'm an Aries and I'm fiery, but you have to be really nice to make any headway here. You have to keep going and talking to them. And it actually does change their mindset or the way that some of them work, that they do let them off the chain because you show them it's okay to let them off the chain, or you need to walk your dog, you know, 20 minutes a day so then it's not going to chase the chickens, or maybe you need to put the chickens in a separate place for the animals. But yeah, and then that family became a paid foster carer for me. I actually used them because I just started Mission Plausible. Mission Plausible didn't exist. I was just still rescuing and I would pay them to foster and feed and then I could rehome them from that place. So then they made money. I knew they were good with dogs. The original big dude, he had nothing to do with it. Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting way that things can manifest here.
And then I guess from a cultural perspective, is it like you're admitting defeat or you're weak if you have an animal you can't take care of and you admit that and you bring it somewhere? Is that not a thing out there?
No, I don't think so. I think it's they don't want to spend their money on it. And then you've got the ceremonies. Money's better spent on ceremonies than it is on your animal. And the animal is the lowest of the family. Right? You know, if the dog's there for security, that's what the dog's there for. It's not there to, it's not a showpiece. There's so many layers to it. There's so many layers. It's not straightforward. Like in Australia, where I'm from, you neglect an animal, then you're just known as a piece of scum. But there is no justification to you doing that unless you do not have money. But then, you know, we've got support networks that, yes, you can give it to a shelter. I don't agree with that. But, you know, you can alleviate the dog, or chaining a dog to a tree in direct sun. That's just an asshole move. Like, that's just really unforgivable. So, you know, that in Australia, there's no excuse for misbehaving. And interestingly, my brother is a security guard in a prison. Sorry, this is a bit of a jump.
No, that's fine.
He works with hardcore criminals, right? Like, we're talking hardcore. And I went, he lives in Darwin, and I went to Darwin and I said, and his dogs were barking a lot. And I was like, wow, your dogs bark a lot. He only has two. He's like, yeah. And I said, aren't you worried someone's going to poison them? And he almost fell off his chair. He's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, that's normal. Like, people poison dogs all the time in Bali because they're noisy. He's like, are you insane? If someone poisoned our dog, if any of these dogs got poisoned and they found out who you were, good luck to you. Like, that's how passionate Aussies are about their pets and their dogs and animal cruelty. Or, you know, he said, oh, if someone put poison in the park and were poisoning dogs and they found that person, and, you know, yeah, good luck to you. Whereas here, and this is the sad part is, and I say that to Julie, that my partner in Mission Plausible, that we are so immune to it now. We're so immune to it. We're so used to it. I'm immune to seeing a dog without hair or a broken leg or poison or death. Like, it's just, it is what it is, you know?
Do you think that the people of Bali, obviously you talked about there being layers to why they may not speak up or why animals are treated a certain way, but do you think that maybe it's almost like they don't see it anymore because it's just so part of everyday life that they just don't see these animals as suffering because it's just, you walk down the street every day and there's animals suffering.
It's always been that way. And where do you start? And I also get it. Like, once you start, how do you stop? You can't. Like, once you, like, for example, we've created Mission Plausible, but to help, but even then I'm overwhelmed. Like, I have to say no. Like, I just can't. I physically cannot. And that brings me back to, this is a community problem. So we can get people reporting animals and saying to me, this is your job. And I'm like, well, actually, if you look at my LinkedIn profile, it's not. But this is a community issue. This is everyone's responsibility. This isn't the one person whose dog, yes, the person whose dog's had puppies and they dumped it, yes, it is theirs, but they're clearly not caring. You've cared enough to contact us about the situation. So we're going to empower you with the tools to help that animal, because Mission Plausible is built in, well, it hasn't intentionally been built this way, but it's how I've created it, is that everyone is responsible for what's going on. So if you find a puppy or a kitten or a dog or what have you, I will help you with the tools to help that animal. But don't expect me to take the animal, because I'm only one person. We are only one group. And I can't tell you how many groups are now on the island saving the dogs here. It's unbelievable. It used to be two. Now I think we're up to 20.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of us on this tiny island helping dogs. Like, you shouldn't have that many groups on a small island. There shouldn't be that many dogs suffering, but and cats. But that's how many there are.
So when did Mission Possible officially start?
2017. I think 2016, I must have left the other rescue group. And I just saw, like I was saying, how charity should be cool, or how to make it cool. It was a really good design challenge, a good brief for me to work out, how do you make something aspirational but feel good and not always down and out. You know, I got really tired of the negativity of charity, of dog rescue. I watched a lot of groups and everything was about the negative. And I thought, this is so exhausting. I think that's also why I had to walk away from the group I was with. It was toxic. It was toxic internally, but it was attracting toxic people. It just had this toxic vibe. And I was like, I have to protect me now. I have to step away. So I continued to rescue. And actually, that's how, while we're on this call, right, is for Stevie Wonder. We'll go back to that in a minute. But yeah, I kept rescuing, and I then needed to obviously pay medical bills. So I created Mission Plausible. I think I started a Facebook page, what have you, but everything was kind of coming to me privately, but on a separate account. And I didn't feel comfortable with this. And one of my biggest dreams was to be on the Dodo.
Yeah, I love the Dodo.
Yeah. And so that was one of my goals, I guess. But I didn't want to be on there until I was registered as a charity. So from being at the previous charity, I saw how things happened, and I wanted to make sure I was 100% transparent and verified, I guess. And so going through that process in Australia is quite time consuming, bloody frustrating, I tell you what. But anyway, eventually got registered and tax deductible there. And so then I approached the Dodo were already interested, but I said, I'm not interested in having Mission Plausible put up in spotlights until I know we're legitimate and also that I'm secure here in Bali. There's, again, another thing you have to look at is visas and working and what's working, what's not working, how to get around it. I want to help the animals, but if I'm not on the right visa, it's seen as working and raising money. Anyway, it's a whole bloody thing. Anyway, so we got registered and then we got on the Dodo, and we've been on there about, I think, 13 or 14 times now.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so that was 2017, I think we got officially registered. And now we're registered in Indonesia. We created the Yayasan here. Yayasan is an Indonesian charity. And we're registered in the USA.
Amazing.
And tax deductible. So yeah, so hopefully we can do Europe and Singapore and, you know, England and Singapore and other bigger countries that now we're getting a big following from. Yeah. I just think being registered, when you're dealing with donations and money and coming, you know, people supporting you, I just really believe in being officially set up and monitored, governmentally monitored, then rather than just throwing money into a sinkhole where you don't know where it's going. And that's what I learned from the other not-for-profit. Yeah, there's dodgy stuff that can happen, especially in Indonesia. I think everywhere, actually, especially when it comes to animals, you're using a very emotive platform, an emotive product. That's why I got registered.
Yeah, and I would say there at least seems to be a little more awareness or interest in people who donate to charities knowing exactly where that money's going, because there have been cases here, at least in the US and Canada, where people find out only, you know, 25% of their donation actually makes it to where they want it to go. So I think that that's super important, just the transparency of like, this is where your money is directly going. Yeah, I think that's super important.
Yeah, and you can be transparent to a point, because when, we are, but like if say, but at the moment we're trying to sponsor a dog. Well, say Hudson, and a dog can have as many sponsors as it wants. You're not the only person that's sponsoring Hudson, for example. And you need to know that Hudson doesn't get all the money. And I had that at the other charity. They're like, wait, I'm sponsoring Otis. And I was like, yeah, but we don't give $25 to Otis. We don't just feed Otis and not Molly, because Molly doesn't have anyone. It's spread across. Like, your donation for a sponsorship is the overarching operations of the whole facility. You know, $1 might go to electricity, $1 might pay a staff member, $1 will feed the dog that you've sponsored. It doesn't, like, come on, let's be realistic about this. It doesn't mean Toto gets to sleep on a king-size bed and Bobo over there is sleeping on a nothing and he gets fed a wafer and no water because he's not the favorite. So yeah, it's also, but now I'm in the sponsoring, I've made that very clear on the page. When you sponsor, I explain, this is what you're paying, like this is what you're donating towards. And if it fits you, great. If it doesn't, that's okay too. But you can't expect me to give one dog a roast chicken and the other one some kibble, because that's just not how we roll. So it's also interesting dealing with humans within the charity space of their expectation. God, there's a lot of learning.
Yeah.
There's a lot of learning.
Oh, I can imagine. And then so when Mission Possible started, was it just out of your home, or where did it start as a foster-based organization, or it kind of grew into that?
Well, basically, because I was working, I'd been volunteering at the other association, I saw how not to do things. So when I left there, a lot of people were intrigued because they knew I was very, very passionate about where I'd been. And so a lot of people then kind of moved over to follow Mission Possible because they liked me and what I did. And then the story of Stevie Wonder comes about.
Thank you so much to Prue for recording this episode with me. I really hope that you enjoyed it. In the show notes, I've included Mission Possible's Instagram handle, which is at Mission Possible, with possible being spelt P-A-W-S-I-B-L-E. So please do go give them a follow. If you would like to donate to this organization and help save more dogs like Winston, I've included the link to do so in the show notes as well. It took me less than a minute to set up a monthly sponsorship for one of Mission Possible's adoptable dogs, so it's really easy to do if you can. Finally, I've included a few of those Dodo videos that Prue had mentioned in the show notes if you wanted to check those out. Please do tune in next week to hear the conclusion of my conversation with Prue Barber and to hear all about Stevie Wonder, Prue's adorable animal soulmate. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a positive rating or review. Follow us on Instagram at Animal Soulmates Pod for updates and pictures of our guests with their beautiful animal soulmates. This podcast is produced by Citizens of Sound. Our theme song is Mastering the Art by Big Score Audio. Have a story that would be a good fit for the show? Send me an email at animalsoulmatespod@outlook.com. That's animalsoulmates with an S, P-O-D, at outlook.com. Finally, are you thinking about adding an animal to your family? Why not consider adoption through your local animal shelter? There are plenty of dogs and cats just waiting to become someone's animal soulmate. See you next time!